My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And Dawn Llewellyn is my guest this week. Dawn is Senior Lecturer in Christian Studies at the University of Chester. We first met about a decade ago when Dawn was waiting to hear the result of her PhD viva. And we learn that Dawn's father is a professional golfer, her mother was a nurse. We discuss the vocational dimension to our respective jobs in academia. Dawn talks about the importance in her life of open water swimming and how she swam the English Channel around a year ago. We talk about the importance of having a counterpoint to our day jobs and the different forms that they can take and the importance of community. For example, Dawn talks about how her PhD studied the way women use literature to reinforce their sense of self and of forming communities and how a book can be a friend. We learn that golf dominated Dawn's childhood. The first gigs that she went to was New Kids on the Block, and the first album was by The Beautiful South. We also find out about Dawn's Bucks Fizz confession, why she used to think there were two Cliff Richards, and why she will always cry at a live gig. And that prompts a discussion around the tinge of pain that's involved in nostalgia. Now, Dawn tells us how she ended up in academia, how going to Canada was a foundational experience for her, and she recalls her first feminist theology class and why she wanted to study Christianity through a feminist lens. She also talks about the importance of taking time out before doing her PhD and about the skills that she learned from teaching English as a foreign language. We then move on to talk about how we navigate the passage of time and whether we recognise ourselves from photographs from our past. And we learn why Dawn doesn't hold on to sad memories, why she likes reminiscing. And we talk about whether it is possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. Dawn also discusses why memories can be anxiety-inducing. And she tells us why her 15-year-old self would be surprised to find out what she is doing now. Then, at the end of the interview, Dawn talks about how she finds that Facebook enables us to catch up with old friends and how it can bring stability to those friendships. And then right at the end, Dawn reveals whether she is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So an absolute privilege this week to meet Dawn Llewellyn for my latest nostalgia interview. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to meet, or remeet indeed, because it's about a year since we last caught up, but Dawn Llewellyn from the University of Chester. So good to see you again.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to see you.
And I think the first time I met you, as we were just saying before we started recording this, you were just about to have your PhD viva.
Yeah.
And here you are now, and you've been at Chester for how many years?
This will be my ninth year in November. So when we did meet, it was that horrible kind of transitional time where everyone's kind of saying, what are you going to do now? I said, I don't know, I haven't even got my viva yet. It was an odd time, but it was nine years here now.
And it's quite an exciting period because it's a limbo type period. But in that time, there's nothing you can do. That's the bit that you can't change anything, and you're at the mercy of forces outside of your control. But sometimes you just think, well, go with it. You know, you can either spend the whole time panicking, chewing your fingernails, or you can just say, well, make the most of it and just wait for the inevitable day, but make the most of your time in the meantime.
Yeah, I had a slightly different approach. I'm really good at it when someone kind of tells me what to do. Yeah. I mean, how do you revise for something that you've basically kind of made up, set the exam, set the content, right? You can't, it's hard to revise, but I just consumed Rowena Murray's How to Survive Your Viva, and I just went through all the things that she said to do, all the little writing kind of tasks that she says, all the ways in which she helps you revise, and I still recommend that book to my students as soon as they've finished and submitted. Go and read that.
So I can tell you a story though. I had one PhD student who he never quite got to PhD, but I remember the first day he started, he said, which book would you recommend? And I said, pardon? And he said, no, is there like a book, like a go-to book? And I thought, well, wrong question.
Yeah, that's right.
I think we need to have a conversation.
Yeah, but, so yeah, but at least, yes, yeah. So
the, it all went fine, by the way.
Yes, yeah, I was going to say, I think, yeah, you weren't that person. Yeah. So but tell me a bit then, Dawn, about your prehistory. But so, obviously you did the PhD at Lancaster.
Yeah, yeah.
But what about your background? Sort of, where were you born?
Well, I was born in Staffordshire, but we didn't live there for very long after that. We moved around quite a lot. I think I'd had like 3 or 4 primary schools by the time I was 5. I went to 4 different secondary schools. My sister was born in Malta. We lived in Warwickshire a couple of times. I tend to say I grew up in Yorkshire because we lived there for the longest. I grew up in Thirsk in North Yorkshire. And then I did my A-levels in North Wales, but my mum and dad now live in Bridgend. So, and then of course I was at university around all of that as well.
Goodness, so were your parents moving?
Yeah, my dad is a professional golfer, so he played on the European Tour as a competitor and represented Wales and had a very good career that way. But then when he started to do a bit more coaching, he started to then also kind of manage kind of golf courses and things, so that's why we moved around. So there's a pretty niche profession, so you kind of have to to go where the work is, I guess.
Yeah. So in a way what you've done is very different, but my dad was on the railway for years, and although what he did for 48 years and what I do is different, it's not that different, because the same sort of commitment to a particular thing, a project, and the sort of the stamina that goes with that is very similar.
It's I think. So, and my dad is a fairly established coach, and of course what we spend most of our time doing is teaching and mentoring and coaching our students. So I think there are similarities in that. He didn't go to university. He was 17 when he turned pro. He was incredibly young and travelled for most of his kind of playing career. My mum is from Belfast and she is a nurse, so she did have some kind of like post-16 training in the 70s around that. So, but neither of them, you know, went to university, but both of them did vocational jobs, and I think what we do is does have that kind
of course it is. It's commitment.
All-encompassing. Yeah. This is your life.
This
isn't
is the
a
course.
Job.
Yeah. Yeah, because somebody once said to me years ago, oh, but you know, when you retire, you're not going to look back and think, well, I wish I'd spent more time at work. But I thought, that's the difference between a job and a vocation, because I don't know where the lines are drawn. I don't know if I'm at the cinema or if I'm in my office. Sometimes everything is sort of kind of intertwined, because the job sort of doesn't have a clear 9-to-5 designated, this is what you do. To a large extent, it's what you make of it.
It is, and I think that's part. That is a bit of a problem. It can be hard to stop. It's actually quite undisciplined, isn't it, to just keep working all of the time. It's more disciplined to try and have boundaries and start and stop times. But, you know, and I'm learning that. I'm still not very good at it. I don't think any of us are, really, if you're in the academic game. But it takes a lot, doesn't it, to stop and say, no, I'm not going to take that research book on holiday. I'm going to read a novel instead. It's those kind of practices that you have to put in place, because you can't work all of the time.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny, because I'm up here in Chester. But this is the first year when I've, you know, been able to say, well, you know, it's like bespoke, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is, for many people, you know, spending a week on the beach might be an ideal holiday. I don't think I could do that, but going traveling around lots of different places, meeting people, but also within that, like I met your colleague Steve this morning, and you know, I went around Chester and saw this guy throwing fire into his barrows and everything. So I thought, you know, this is a genuine holiday, but it's a very structured holiday, and in that sense, and it's also kind of research related as well.
Yeah.
So, and I think you're right; it's something very vocational. When you explain what you do to people, they sort of think, that's odd. That's interesting. You know, not for me.
And also I think I still kind of have to explain to people that, you know, university doesn't shut down over the summer. We don't have the long kind of vacation. Yeah. And when I kind of say, oh, well, I'm going to this conference or I'm writing this paper, it does need a little bit of translating. For a long time, you do have to just, especially when you're doing your PhD or you've got a big project on, trying to explain to your friends and colleagues and family members that you can't do this, you can't go there because you're writing to a deadline. But luckily I've got very patient, very understanding family and friends who don't mind.
but also just reminded me that you obviously said your dad is a professional golfer, but I also know that you do, I don't know if it's professional, but swimming, mm-hmm. I mean serious swimming, like channel, swimming across the channel.
I did swim by myself. No, I did do it in a relay. There were three of us in total. Yeah, sport's quite a big part of my family. My aunt, Karen, she was captain of Yorkshire hockey for a very long time, and she's also represented, she's represented England, so my dad's represented Wales and she's represented England, and their father, my grandfather, he was a PTI in the Marines, so quite a sporty family. My mum's quite sporty, but the swimming, I was a kind of mediocre club swimmer as a child. You know, we lived in Thirsk, most of my friends were members of the swimming club. Mum and dad had friends, you know, parents were all friends, so it was really close knit, really sociable group. So I swam competitively from the age of about 7 to about the age of 14, and then stopped because it was school, and you know, you get distracted as a teenager around things. And then about 5 years ago went started open water swimming, which is a different kettle of fish from just bombing up and down a 25-metre pool, you know, with 30 other people or whatever. So yeah, open water swimming. So I tend to do 5K and 10K events and races, and but the swimming the channel there, that was last year's focus, really. And so I did that with two other friends in a relay.
And do you think it's a good counterpoint to the academic work, because you sort of need, because I've got a colleague who I've interviewed who does a lot of sailing and water activity in Whitstable, and he says that you know, if he was asked to define himself, he wouldn't say that he's a philosopher, if that's his job, but he couldn't do one without the other. He needs something, you know, the water sport is an important counterpoint to the office-based work. So sort of one, I suppose, myself, I do a lot of cinema work. I say cinema work, I go to the cinema, let's be clear. You know, so I think,
You are constantly at the cinema. Your Facebook profile is just a list of the 18 movies you've seen over 3 days.
Actually, it's really funny because on Facebook, obviously if I go to the cinema, I'm because I've got all the reviews up. But because I'm at work every day, but also if I then said, you know, and now I'm on my 7th essay, people think, oh no, you know, we don't want to know this. So of course, we're very selective in what we put out. But of course, I'm aware that if people think, you know, that's all Chris does, but it's like, yeah, but the other like 22 hours are not documented. Yes. That's what the diary's
but
for.
But you're watching movies and calling it research. Yeah. I've got, you know, some of your choices are dubious. Bad Moms 2, I was, Chris, what are you doing?
I know. But of course, also, what was funny about that is the apostrophe or the lack of in that title, because I got one colleague who's a linguist, and she said it doesn't need to have an apostrophe, but I thought, well, it's called A Bad Mom's Christmas, and there was no apostrophe there, and I don't know, although it depends which is the plural in that. I don't know, is it the moms or
I would say
Christmas?
It's probably not my primary concern about that movie.
No, but the thing that I learned in that, because there's the ritual of cinema going, but also the people watching. So I'm watching the film, but when I saw that film, I was conscious that I went, as I always do, on my own, but it was very much a group event, and there was a group of, I think they were mixed age, but there was some female audience members in front of me, and suddenly halfway through, one of them said, come on girls, let's have a selfie, and they did, they all like posed for the selfie during the film,
that's
and
so
then
nice.
Carried on watching.
Aww,
and I was, but also I thought, in a funny way, I don't need 3D glasses, obviously the film wasn't 3D, because what I was watching, there was an interactivity, and there was a sense that the film, what was happening in the audience was also kind of what was, it was the film spilling out, you know, so that, and it was the audience engagement bit. Yeah. So I did learn something from that film, even though obviously it does, the content is dubious,
But I think we do have to have something else to do. You know, you're saying about something, you know, being a counterpoint, whatever that other thing might be. I'm quite a busy, noisy, easily distracted person, and I'm never as still. Swimming is where I'm still in the water. I'm obviously moving, but my brain is quite still. It's open water swimming, you know, it doesn't matter what the weather is like. It's just, it sounds a bit kind of gushy, but it is just you and the water. It's just you, and the only thing you've got to do is put one arm in front of the other and keep kicking and keep a regular breathing. It is very meditative. And there's sometimes, the only way I can describe it, there's been some swimming experiences I've had where it's been really elemental. It feels like there's only you in the world and the water. And it is the only time I ever get that total kind of brain completely still. I'm not conscious. Hours, you know, literally hours can go by, and I've been swimming for maybe, you know, like 4 hours or something, and I don't know what I thought about.
That's really interesting, actually, because I find that it's difficult in some ways for me to. I don't necessarily mean physically still, but I kind of feel I'm always active in one form or another. But going to the cinema requires me, particularly if there are other people around me, to be very aware of the surroundings. So I'm, you know, there's a sense of discipline there. I can stay in the office all day, but it's the sense in which you know sometimes that in order to find an equilibrium, and that's maybe the key word here, a balance in life. If you can go to work every day, you could in theory burn yourself out.
Yeah.
But if you have something else going on that kind of offsets what your primary thing is, it reinforces the primary thing rather than just feel that you're, because sometimes we all have those when there's just too much going on and you feel that you're making more work for yourself. And sometimes, like, if I've got a batch of essay marking, then that my way of dealing with that is just to mark them all in, obviously, because they're not going to mark themselves, and it gives me there's a lot of anxiety and do that.
Yeah.
So other things would give in that sense.
Yeah, I think it's a strange sport. Swimming. My partner Bran, who is a very supportive towel holder and tea maker, when he's watching me swim round, splashing about in some, you know, lake in North Wales or something, and he's like, it must be really, really boring. It must be really dull. You've just got your face down some muddy, murky lake or the English Channel. But you're taking in the scenery, and like I said, you're kind of, I'm kind of often quite hyper aware of how the water feels, or what, you know, I might see some wildlife, or you're kind of like, you're noticing the water changing with the light and the temperature and the weather. And so I didn't understand when he said it's just really boring to watch. It is just really boring to watch. But you're kind of isolated. It is just you, and at the same time, it's really incredibly sociable. So it's you know, you are really aware of your surroundings, and you know, I've met loads of lovely friends through swimming, and we swim together. You can't chat and swim together because your head's down. But at the same time, there is a sense of being really connected.
Yeah. So. And often, because although I go to the cinema on my own, it's unbelievably interactive because I'm sharing that with other people afterwards through Facebook, etc.
Yeah.
So in a way, there are some things that are like, if you're doing a PhD, well, of course, you can only do that on your own, but of course, you need a community of some kind to bounce off. Sometimes you need a supervisor, you know, so there's always going to be some form of community or social relationship.
And we can be a bit too quick sometimes to kind of polarise individual events and activities and community events. So my PhD was on reading practices, women's religious and spiritual reading practices. And I kind of set out thinking that, well, readings, you know, it is a highly individualised community. A lot of the literature suggested women might be using it as a resource for thinking through to faith development or spiritual development or identity, and those kind of very personal questions. You know, how are women using literature to resource their sense of self? And reading kind of wrote actually in the end that reading was a way of forming kind of community for the women, not only through the actual activity, but through the connections my participants were making with characters, or the author, the kind of deep beloved feeling you have of loving an author, and feeling like they reported quite close personal relationships with an author that they'd never met and never would meet. But also the book itself, they, you know, a lot of my participants described the books that they felt had become their sacred texts as their friends. And yet this started with kind of an activity that is just, you know, you and one thing.
Yeah.
But some of my participants imagined the community of readers that also had read the book and kind of traversed through this particular book's, you know, pages.
Yeah.
So we are a bit too quick sometimes, aren't we, to kind of separate the individual and those communal things. And other scholars have talked about how reading can be a social glue because of the way in which we imagine ourselves connected to other readers at other times.
No, because you're absolutely right, because I sometimes find that if you're reading something on Kindle, then there's the opportunity for you to share. And sometimes something come up, and maybe it's like just preset that way, and it'll say, this particular passage has had X number of interactions. And, you know, if you press this button on your pad, then you can add a comment as well, and then see what other people are saying about that particular line in Wuthering Heights or on Academy, but whatever it might be. And in that sense, it's very participatory.
And book clubs, if you think how important book clubs are to so many people in so many ways. And I think that's an under-researched area, and particularly in terms of religious studies. Lots of book groups belong, are part of religious institutions, religious organisations, but it is a kind of community event where people make lots of friends. And a lot of the time it's not even about the book with book with book clubs. It's more about the space in which you share that experience. Yeah.
No, because one of the questions I'll ask in a minute is about music. But for me, when I was young, you might listen in a solitary sense to the music that's on the radio, but then at school the next morning, we'd all be sharing our, did you hear that song at 8 o'clock this morning? Yeah. Wasn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And, you know, some of us would agree, some of us would disagree. But what bound us together was that, yeah, we may have listened very, obviously solipsistically, but, you know, very individually and in our own environments to something, but there was that need to share. You know, it's like seeing a good film. You have to
you have to go and talk to someone about it, don't you? I'm a
proselytiser. Yeah, like, you must see this film.
And I think that's what, certainly for my participants in that project, that was one of the ways in which they were physically making communities, was with that. I've just read this book, it's life-changing. Literally trying to put it into somebody else's hands so that experience can kind of be continued. And I think that kind of water cooler conversation about what you listened to on the radio the night before, or what you might have watched on the on the TV or seen the film the night before, I kind of thought that might be lessened with, you know, streaming and watching Netflix and catch up and stuff. But I don't think it is. We, as a department, I don't know if you know this, we have coffee almost every single day at 11 o'clock together if we're not teaching or not in a meeting. And most of the chat isn't about, you know, kind of deeply theoretical religious studies things. It's you know, it's often about what TV series we're binge watching, and that, so that sense of kind of having that shared collective experience of watching TV, I don't think has gone just because of the streaming or Netflix stuff.
And the intersection sometimes between what would perhaps traditionally be calling it the trivial and the substantive, there's a very porous line, because we can be, I mean, for me, I was fixated when I was young on the charts, and somebody else just like, well, somebody counting down a bunch of records that you don't like. But for me, it's almost like if I hear something like Pick of the Pops on the radio now, particularly if it's a chart that I remember first time when I was growing up, you know, there's a sense in which, even if I'm driving in the car, I'm completely consumed by this. And it really does, and it's sort of, you know, waiting for that moment, the heart is pounding to see what's number one, even though it was number one 30 years ago. It's reliving that. And to somebody else, I mean, then again, I don't get sport in the same way.
Okay.
I don't get excited about sport in the way that, no doubt, you know, you would.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, for example, a few years ago, there was a Football World Cup, I think it was, many years ago, and everybody was like, people were taking time off work to watch it. I wasn't really interested at all, and I wasn't part of the big community going on. But there'll be other communities that I do feel on film is an obvious one, like Oscar night or something.
So in
a way, I think we just have our own individual sort of way in, but we all do the same sort of thing, but we just have different communities and sub-communities with whom we'll engage.
I think so.
What about things you remember doing as a child? What are your sort of earliest memories or things you enjoy from childhood?
Well, there was my mum, my dad, myself, and my younger sister. And sport has always been part of our family life. So all of our holidays would be scheduled around my dad's playing programme. And my sister is 3 years younger than me. And I used to really love going and watching my dad play tournaments. And I used to go from quite a young age. And he would wake me up kind of quite early, and I'd go with him to the practice ground at the tournaments beforehand, and my mum would pack me like a little pack up for the day, just sandwiches and, you know, like some biscuits and stuff, and I'd follow my dad round by myself. And my sister was a bit too young, so mum often had to kind of like look after her, and my sister was and found golf very dull, and whenever she was there at five or six, would, you know, kind of be going, Dad, this is so boring. Have you finished work yet? And you know, so I remember most things being around that. So when my sister was born in Malta, my dad was the golf pro at the golf course there. And then when we moved back to England, we lived in Thurscombe North Allerton Golf Club because mum and dad ran that. So my sister and I would kind of like run off and disappear onto the golf course and play when it wasn't very busy. But at the same time, Mum and Dad were kind of always on call, and there would always be events that my mum was catering for and my dad was organising. And then when my dad went back on playing on the tour again, when I was must have been about 8 or 9, he would be away quite a lot of the time, and we lived in Thirsk, and Thirsk is a small historic market town in North Yorkshire, so everybody knew everyone else. And then again we moved to Warwickshire, and then again Dad was like in charge of a golf course. Mum and Dad were in charge of a golf course. So, you know, revising for GCSEs, it would, you know, it would be Mum and Dad would be, you know, be working, and I'd be at home revising, or then I'd work on a Saturday in the golf shop or in the clubhouse kind of waitressing. So I have to say golf kind of has dominated most of my kind of growing up.
And what about your sister? Did she end up, did she fall in, did she give up, did she yield in the end?
No, she still found it quite boring and found it very restraining environment. Because you have to be quiet on a golf course. You can't tell a six-year-old to be quiet on a golf course. Especially when it's just this like, you know, huge expanse of space which you can go and hide and play. Yeah. So no, she's never really followed it. She is she works in the arts. She trained as an actor. She's talking about niche jobs, as we were talking about earlier. She is a fight director and stage combat choreographer. So if there's a theatre director who is, you know, trying to set up some kind of fight between two actors, someone like my sister will come and choreograph it and teach the actors to fight safely. But with all that training, comes this quite acute knowledge of different styles and historical. She knows loads about the history of fighting. So, I mean, this is a rubbish example, but you'll be watching a film and it'll be set in 1792 or something, and she'll go, they wouldn't have used that move till about 1850. You know, so so that's what she does. So both of us went in, quite different directions.
Yeah. No, it's funny because I saw, because a friend recommended it, Horrible Histories.
Oh, I know, I want to see it!
And what was funny, because it's obviously set in the time of Nero.
That's right.
But obviously it's started off, it's Carry On meets Monty Python. And obviously it's not a remotely historic, you know, the language that's used. But it plays on that, and it's very knowing as well that this wouldn't have happened. And they burst the song, but it's like, so, you know, the song out of you know, A Star Is Born or Mamma Mia or something. So, you know, it's playing on the whole you know, this is how we would, from our present sensibility, engage with that. But I've often thought when watching films sometimes, and even if it's like fairly recent past, like the 1990s, because I remember the 90s, but when you watch a film and you sort of see, and you know, I'm always looking, and you think, people didn't really use mobile, didn't really have mobile phones back then. So of course you're looking in the shot to make sure that the car sort of looked from that period. But you know, but it's part of that thing, like, is there something that's going to gel, or somebody's wearing a watch that isn't from that era? But your sister obviously is trained in that sort of mindset.
And there's not very many women in the country who do this. And she works for a small company run by two women who started it about 2 years ago, and about 10 years ago. And it's very much a boys' club, they're kind of paving the way as kind of women stage fight directors. So exciting.
But what about, you mentioned charts a moment ago. I mean, did music play a part in your childhood growing up? Were there particular sounds that represented your childhood?
I think, like most of us, you know, long car journeys, fighting over what tapes to go on that would kind of keep everybody happy or not offend everybody, you know, too much, and learning all the words to all the songs. And I think, like most people, you're influenced by who your parents listen to. So we grew up on things like Carole King and Simon and Garfunkel and the Beatles and the Beach Boys and, you know, all of that. And my dad, again, loves music. My mum does as well. And my partner now is a musician in his free time. So we've always got stuff on. I think the first gig, though, I ever went to see, you know, I feel like this is a confession, but it wasn't really my fault, Chris. It wasn't my choice. It was New Kids on the Block, who were huge when I was about 12 or 13. I was never really into them, but a friend of mine bought me a ticket, So we went, and it was just this huge, it was in the NEC, Birmingham, so this huge stadium tour, and I felt a bit like a fish out of water, because I didn't really know many of the words to the songs, and all you, I just remember screaming, but then Mum and Dad would take us to, I think I'd seen like Neil Diamond and John Denver in concert by the time I was about 15 or 16, so but I think the first, you always remember the first record you ever bought, that you kind of discovered for yourself, that you felt nobody else knew who this band was, and for me that was Beautiful South. And I saved up when I was about 10 to buy their first album, Welcome To, and I saved and saved and saved and had it on LP and just played it to death, played it all of the time, you know, again, learned all the words to all songs, and if I didn't quite catch the lyrics to the first lines, I'd like take you know, take the needle back to make sure that I got the lyrics, and I'd sit with the lyrics and try and learn them, and they're still probably one of my favourite bands ever. But I felt like I'd discovered them, and then I was like a bit disappointed when I found out that other people knew who they were.
It can work both ways, because sometimes you feel this is my idiosyncratic childhood, and you sort of, you want to share it, but you find that somebody else has a very different way into that, and you've got to navigate the path. Like, we have something in common, but also you don't want to sort of sacrifice that independent discovery, which is unique to your childhood.
My other confessions from before the age of 10 would be Bucks Fizz. Still a huge Bucks Fizz fan. I think I've even got that on my like kind of Twitter profile. Bucks Fizz fan. Very happening, bopping away to Bucks Fizz. My dad bought me In the Land of Make-Believe, I think for my 6th birthday, as my single, because I just love that song. And then the other thing that my parents still take the mickey out of me for this day, was that I used to think there were two Cliff Richards. There was this like old guy who was in the charts sometimes, and then there was this young guy who was like in all these great movies that I wanted to sing and dance, you know, along to, and again like pretend to be in the movie. And I was devastated when I realised they were the same person.
Well, I was listening to one of the top of the Pick of the Pops, and I think it was like 1959 and 1992, and of course Cliff Richard appeared in both charts. Yes. In fact, they went through a period of actually, I don't think there's ever been a Pick of the Pops when he hasn't appeared at least in one of the years, because he spanned all his generations.
And, you know, my dad and mum remembered him from the late 50s, early 60s, when he was, you know, the kind of British version of Elvis, right? So, you know, a bit of a...
And I was at Leeds Castle once, and they closed early because he was performing that evening. And we knew he'd already arrived, because we were walking or exiting through the courtyard, and there was this really sort of snazzy-looking car. And what was the number plate? Move it.
No, really? Well, he deserves that. He can have that. Yeah. Wouldn't be quite right if anyone else had.
And I saw him. I did see him in concert, but it was at the cinema, because I think it was maybe in Manchester, but it was shown, you know, in cinemas across the land just a few months ago. And he still goes on about how, you know, it should have been a number one, and he talks about what was number one, and how you know, at the end of the day, he sort of, you know, lasted the course, and others dropped away. You know, he's had more hits than the Beatles. It was like, oh dear, you know.
Then I was just kind of thinking about I teach a little bit of religious studies and popular culture here as part of a sociology of religion module, and so we do that whole, you know, like kind of what songs, you know, what are the tracks of your kind of your years, and I always give them like a bit of REM, or, you know, Losing My Religion, and that album, you know, REM got me through my GCSEs, as did Crowded House, Woodface. I think both of those, I remember revising all the way through my GCSEs with them. But I was also a bit of an indie kid, so I had my Doc Martens with my James t-shirt and the James logo Tipex on to my Doc Martens and the Wonder Stuff. And we went to we go to quite a lot of gigs now, and we went to a festival in Manchester, and it was all 90s Britpop. So it was the Blue Tones, the Wonder Stuff headlining, Echo and the Bunnymen as well, but Jesus Jones. And I was like jigging around to Jesus Jones, and Brown was just like, who are these? I said, where were you in 1992 when Doubt came out and it was the greatest album of all time? But what struck me about that is I don't think I've listened to that album since since I was about 15 or 16, and yet here I was, you know, May, just this May just gone, remembering all the words to International Bright Young Thing. And you think, what is it that you still remember? And again, it was a bit like you were saying, I was right back, you know, kind of, you know.
No, because, you know, my first ever record was Bucks Fizz, Making Your Mind.
No! Yes. Are you kidding me?
1981.
Oh, Chris, this is meant to be.
And Land of Make-Believe, I used to, you know, and I'd have the, but on that, the single on the 45, if you opened it up, there were four or five different images from the different band members and of the Land of Make-Believe. I had that on my wall, and I'd be, and I sometimes opened the curtains a little bit at, you know, 5 a.m. or whatever, just so I could see the line. So I was obsessed with Cheryl Baker and, you know, and that was... Yeah, and you mentioned Beautiful South, and of course, I still to this day, I never know what I love you from the bottom of my pencil case means.
Yeah.
But also, I don't want to know. I don't want to deconstruct it, because I've spent 30 years not knowing but loving that song. So it's almost as though it, you know, it deserves just to stand alone. Do not deconstruct that. Don't give that as a gobbit passage.
No, that's right. No, keep it for me. Keep it precious. We went to see Heaton and Abbott this year, and I think we've seen, I think I've seen them about 5 or 6 times. And he is... It was such a brilliant gig, and they still play their new stuff, but he still does, you know, Paul Heaton will still play that, and he's such a fantastic lyricist. He is a poet. He is totally, you know, a poet. There's always this beautiful kind of framing of the images they create, and he's always been attentive to gender. He's always been attentive to class, and always been attentive to race. And but you know, when you're like 9 or 10, you're not really hearing that.
Yeah.
You kind of notice that afterwards, but. It's whenever I hear "I'll Sail This Ship Alone," it makes me cry. It made me cry when I was about 9 or 10, and I had no idea what it was about, and it still does.
Yeah.
But I can't go and see a live gig without crying, so I'll always cry at some point during a live gig.
Yeah, no, and I think that we all. I mean, it's also the association, because I can remember both the time I originally heard a particular song, but often all the different layers, you know, the subsequent listens, and the people that you're listening to it with, and I find that. I particularly remember times of year, and particularly if there's a coincidence of when I recorded something that I listen to now in my car that I recorded 30 years ago. But if it, as it often does, you know, coincides with that particular date, like it might be the run up to Christmas, and suddenly, and I'm immediately taken back to that time and place. To find I can almost like might be in a particular social environment in Lampeter where I was a student, but on the day that was recorded, and I can smell that pub, and I can smell the pool table and the drinks from the bar, and the people and the conversations, and you know, so I'll be driving, this is going on, I feel wow, you know, this is a bit too much.
But then it gets another layer. Yeah. Because you then remember the feeling of remembering the feeling. So there's another association there, isn't it? Kind of built on top of that.
And I think that's why I have an ambivalence sometimes about reunion, because I do that now. But sometimes you always feel that maybe the other people who you shared that with, who are an indissoluble part of that growing up period, may not
feel
the same. Might think, what are you talking about, don't remember it.
Yeah.
I almost then don't want to know, because that would, well I don't know, it wouldn't change the memories I have, but it would kind of, it would all, you know, feel that something was missing, because if it meant that much to me, how could that not be a shared thing?
Yeah, and then if it doesn't, there's a tinge of disappointment, isn't it, when it doesn't have that same meaning.
The friendships weren't completely reciprocal.
And I was thinking, just this week, kind of thinking about the podcast and nostalgia, and I was just thinking, it is always tinged, it does always hurt a little bit, I think, doesn't it, when you're feeling nostalgic. It can be quite joyous, but there can sometimes be, there is a little bit of pain sometimes, because of either that association, or again a kind of a worry that it might not be shared in that way. It is a really layered thing. I was I lived in Portugal for a few years, because I taught English as a foreign language before after finishing my master's, and before I started my PhD, and travelled a bit as well. And the Portuguese, there's a phrase, saudish, and it just kind of means like a longingness or a missingness, but it doesn't quite translate that way either, and people often say it's the closest would be a kind of a longing or a missingness with a bit of nostalgia kind of thrown in, and the word does try and capture that. Sometimes it can be like it can sting a little bit, I guess.
But we'll come on to that a bit later, because I think you're right, because there's the way that we negotiate the past, and whether we all, you know, gloss over sometimes what's happened. But before we do all that, how did you end up in academia? So what made you take that route?
Oh, right. So I did my undergraduate at Edinburgh and had no idea what I wanted to do. And I think for the first 2 years of my undergraduate, really, really coasted, actually. Just wasn't quite sure what my voice was, wasn't sure what my interests were, you know, was navigating all of that. And, you know, sometimes getting it right for an essay or an exam, and then sometimes not quite getting it right, trying to learn how you structure an argument, how to channel what you might be interested in. But then I was lucky enough to go on an exchange program to Kingston in Canada, to Queen's University, wow, for a year, where I also then studied philosophy and theology, which is what my undergraduate was. And that blew my mind. It was the first time that I had lecturers, two lecturers in particular, who just took me to one side and just kind of said, look, you have got something to say. So what do you think you might want to do when you finish your undergraduate? And I said, oh, I don't know, teach maybe, or I don't know, law, I might go on a graduate training scheme. And they said, no, don't, why don't you try and think through maybe postgraduate work? And going to Canada was really foundational, because that's when the first time that I'd ever been taught by a woman, and it was the first time I'd ever done any feminist courses. So Edinburgh in, you know, like the late 90s, philosophy and systematic theology, not many women academics in that field. In philosophy, the only women in the department were administrators. I think I had some graduate teachers who were, I had one graduate, postgraduate tutor who was doing her PhD. So I was kind of, did some courses with a particular gender focus, and it was the first time. And I remember my first, I remember my very first feminist theology class, and I start the book with this, actually, because it was Pamela Dickey Young, Introduction to Feminist Theology, and she said, okay, we're just going to read an excerpt from a book here, and then we're just going to talk about it. And I was just like, what? We're not going to, what's this about? And it was The Colour Purple by Alice Walker, a book that I'd read lots of times before, a book I'd seen the movie, you know, loved it, obviously, you know, really challenging. And it was that exchange between Shug and Seeley where they're discussing God, and kind of Shug says to Seeley, yeah, but your idea of God, well, that's just a white guy in the sky, and it's a man, it's got a beard, and that's the God of the white folk, not the God of the black folk. And we were talking about the gendered expectations around language around God. And I'd realised I'd kind of gone through most of my education not really unpacking the way in which I'd gendered God as a white man. Mm. And I'd grown up, my mum's Catholic, so we'd gone to Catholic school, although didn't have a very religious upbringing, really. They were very relaxed around that, but I did go to Catholic high school. And had never really come across feminism. So it was that moment, really, that I thought, actually, I want to find out more about what it means to think about Christianity through a gendered lens. And then I came back to Edinburgh, quite a gobby feminist in my fourth year of university, particularly. But again, I also had really great lecturers who kind of noticed that I was coming back a bit all fired up with this interest in feminist theology, feminist religious studies. And just they really supported that. And one lecturer in particular, he just said to me, you know, like, take a position, take this position that you found, do it. And don't be frightened of taking a feminist position, because that's how you have something to say. And then I wanted to really try and locate feminist theology and feminist religious studies much more broadly within feminism. So the way to do that was to do an MA in women's studies at Lancaster. And I just thought, well, let's see how the MA goes. Let's see how I get on. And it was very interdisciplinary program, but I tended still to kind of lean towards questions around religion and Christianity. And I thought, well, if this goes all right and I'm kind of good enough, then I'll think about a PhD. And I kind of didn't do too badly in the MA, but I did need to take some time off. I think I often say this to students, you know, like, if you want to go all the way through, you know, undergraduate, MA, PhD, that's fine, that's great. But if you're going to take some time off, it might make sense to have a bit of a break, do something else after your MA and before the PhD. Mm. So that's when I lived in Lisbon for 2 years, taught English as a foreign language, had far too much fun, and then went travelling for a couple of years as well. Kind of taught a bit, worked a bit, travelled a bit, and then started the PhD after that. So it was almost like, I think, I just needed to take a bit of a breather before thinking about the PhD, to think about what I wanted to do, and I think something would have been missing if I hadn't. I felt I had more to say around the kinds of things I was starting to think about for my MA.
Yeah, because I really actually look up to some, my students who have jobs.
Yeah.
Because I, in a way, I was lucky. I had a grant, early 90s. The year that I started at university was the year that they froze the grant.
Yeah.
But I had a very, very small student loan, so I was privileged. But these days, you know, students need to work in order to survive, but they have to juggle so many responsibilities, which I didn't have to do. And although on the one hand it's good, you know, I could say I could focus just on my work. At the same time, I've never worked outside the university community. So I think that what you said is right, because I did go from one degree to another to another, but I kind of feel that my life experience has sort of come during and after all of that, and you know, as of course it's ongoing, but it's interesting, if I'd taken a different path, whether I would have had some of the life experiences a bit earlier, so that it wasn't, because you know, the danger was I could have ended up being more of an ivory tower sort of thinker, because I really might not, you know, I was in, you know, I worked, did all my degrees in a very small Welsh town, it was only sort of, you know, I was 31 when I moved to Kent, so I don't regret what I did, but I wouldn't give that, but my advice to others wouldn't be, do what I did, it might be right for some people, but I look back and I'm a bit more, I qualify perhaps some of the things that I did.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know when else would have had those opportunities to do those kind of things. And I did teaching English as a foreign language because I remember half thinking, well, it's a good way to travel, it's a fairly stable career to enable you to travel and work and live abroad, but also there'll always be transferable skills, and I still use some of the tricks and teaching activities that I learned in TEFL in the classroom now, because it teaches you classroom management, it teaches you kind of focusing on learning objectives, it teaches you all of that stuff, it exposes you to how different learners do understand and do engage, and so it was invaluable training actually. It meant when I did start a PhD and was teaching, I was kind of fairly confident quite quickly going into the classroom. But I was the same, you know, Chris, I didn't have to pay fees, I worked during the holidays, but I didn't have to work during term time at university. Yeah. I was fully funded for my master's, right? what is that? British Academy mass funding for the master's. They don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And that is incredibly privileged. So, you know, students, you know, my students, they are just juggling caring responsibilities. A lot of them are living quite close to Chester because they've got caring responsibilities at home. They are trying to manage work, or if they live here, they sometimes have to go home at weekends because there might be family circumstances which demand that of them. And I just think how on earth they manage that. It's just not the same demands, is it, that kind of we had, and yet they successfully navigate well, and they come out the other end, and you know, they've given it all they've got, and they go on to do fantastic things. But we were lucky.
Yeah. And while you were at university, so obviously you were at Edinburgh for your first degree,
and then Lancaster for PhD and the MA. Yeah.
What about lots of sort of events? Did you continue with the sport? I'm guessing that you did.
I played a lot of netball, I played a lot of netball and hockey as well as swimming, when I was in Edinburgh, I was quite involved with the netball squad there and at Lancaster. And then, when I did my PhD, it was mainly swimming and hockey. Yeah. So I flitted around a bit. I haven't always stayed with one sport, really.
Yeah. No, but also maybe that's the key to it, because, you know, in a way sometimes it's... I mean, I think that one of the things that help us get through, you know, decades sometimes often in one job is the sense that, you know, diversity is good, but also you sort of, once you know what works for you, you can then channel that, and then you become the ambassador for
that.
So you need a bit of variety, and holidays can be great, but sometimes, you know, as long as there's a scent, there's a form, there's a structural consistency there somewhere. So like, I go to the cinema all the time, but I'm also at work all the time.
Yeah.
So in a way, I know that the boundaries are fairly, you know, sort of, I never go off the radar.
But no one cares when you're on a hockey pitch or when I'm swimming the English Channel, you know, what my deadlines are or what I've overcommitted to or how much mulking I've got. Yeah. You know, if I'm just splashing around a, you know, a river or the English Channel, no one, I'm not thinking about that. Nobody else is either, because it's such a leveller. It's such a leveller. The other reason I've moved sports a lot is because I'm notorious for getting injured all the time. So I've just had to retire from netball. This season was my last season. At the age of 42, I've hung up my netball trainers because I just, every season, I've had some semi-catastrophic injury, dislocated fingers, ruptured ligaments in both ankles. And that means then that it actually starts interfering with your swimming. And I'm kind of hoping maybe swimming's the way forward because it's kind of hard to fall over when you're swimming. It's quite hard to get too injured. And I have always thought as well that, you know, looking ahead, I might go back to playing golf at some point in my life. My aunt, at the age of 62, has just started playing again after 50 years. And she's loving it. And it's made me think, oh, maybe I might go back and play golf.
It's interesting, isn't it, though, how sometimes we become our parents as well. And when we're younger, there's a sense of rebellion.
That's
sometimes.
Right, you do all you can to resist it.
But then you look in the mirror sometimes and you just think, I am, you know. And actually, go with it, that's embrace nice. It. You know, we've all got the traits, you know, we all have our unique identities. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, you can't escape, I think, who you are. Well, some people do, I guess, but I think ultimately it's when you sort of embrace it and just say, this is me, and I'm the sum, you know, I'm the product of all these different chromosomes, and you just think, wow, you know. And even when you've got siblings, sometimes you realise how different you are as well as how similar. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you never quite know the direction that you're going to go in. That's what makes life, that's the spice of life.
I was at a 20th wedding anniversary party on Saturday for friends of mine who I met first week of university at Edinburgh. And they got married as soon as we graduated. So 20 years ago. So they're the first to get married, really. And as I kind of like looked round the party, my mum and dad came because they've known them as well for as long. And, you know, their mum and dad were there. And and you kind of look around this room and you just get this sense we've kind of all raised each other and they are extended family. And it all fitted into place. My mum and dad were talking to Laura's mum and dad and their kids were running around. And it did all slot in. And it was this kind of, you know, my dad, mum and dad kind of looked at me and they were just like, this is your life, isn't it? I was going, yes, it is. This is like basically most of my life in one room, even though it wasn't my party. But it did all fit into place.
Yeah. It's like looking at photographs sometimes. You feel almost existentially a sense of real pull. Because often you think, when would that be? You know, I was looking at my parents looking at some photographs when I met up with them the other evening.
Yeah.
And I think, well, I remember those days very clearly, but of course, that's how you looked in those days, but I look very different. But mentally, of course, I can remember those periods.
Yeah.
But when I see the picture of myself, I think, no, surely not.
And did you talk to your mum and dad about that? So there's a picture of my sister and I on the windowsill in my mum and dad's kitchen, and we were there. I was there this weekend, and my mum and dad kind of, they say this to us quite, Claire and I quite often, about this one particular photo. I think I'm about 7, so Claire would have been about 4. And they sometimes say to us, that's how you still look. You don't look any different now at the age of 42 and 39.
Yeah.
To us, that's how you look. Yeah. And it's incredibly important to them.
And I have to say, because when I went to my university reunion, there were some people who were my age or just 1 or 2 years older, who I remember when I was an undergraduate, and they look just the same to me. The fact that they haven't aged.
Yeah.
They look, you know, yes, maybe a bit older, but clearly the same person. It's very recognisable features and they sound the same. And my sister was also at Lampeter, and a few of them were asking after her. So I sent her the pictures and I said, obviously you remember these people. And she was like, I'm not so sure. What was the name again? She said, it was a long time ago. I thought, but they look the same. And to me, but not to her.
Yeah. That our friends had their wedding albums out, and there is that sense that we look exactly the same, and yet we look different all at the same time.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to kind of put your finger on what it was. Obviously, you can recognise people, but you're not that person anymore.
Yeah.
So much has changed. It was, you don't all, you kind of remember that moment, but you don't really recognise. I don't really recognise myself as being, you know, like a 22-year-old at their mate's wedding, looking back at these photos.
Well, a few more philosophically based questions to round off. I mean, are your memories predominantly positive?
Yes. I don't tend to hold on to sad memories very often, I don't think. It's not that I let them... I'm not deliberately letting them go. But if I am reminiscing, it tends to be the happy, fun, silly stuff that I remember and recall.
Yeah.
But I am a very gushy person. Like, I do feel things. Like I was saying, you know, I can't go to a gig without crying, for example, or watch an advert a lot of the time without crying. And but yeah, memories. I like reminiscing. I do like reminiscing. It's important. And and again, I think as we get a bit older, I find myself in, you do it more. You know, we were reminiscing loads at this 20th, you know, wedding anniversary. And, you know, do you remember? And it never gets old. And there's always something new that you remember and recall about the story that kind of, again, makes it a sacred story. They are sacred stories. They are how we're narrating and experiencing our life. And they are how we make meaning and continue to make meaning.
And for that reason, it's interesting that you say that, because I've always kept a diary, but I didn't used to write very much.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've just extended quite considerably the amount that I've written. I do it on a computer. But I digitised all my old diary, wrote them all up. But then I couldn't just write up what was on the page in front of me from, you know, 1993.
Yeah.
I had to annotate it, because I'd remember all these additional things that you know, and I knew that in some cases I might be a bit blurry with the past, but I'd do them in italics. It was clear that I wasn't adding to the, as if, you know,
an authentic record,
an interpretation, and that's a clear and important distinction to make. But and I did that because these moments were so precious, so sacred, that in some cases I want, you know, if 25 years on I'm still very much affected by these events, well, and that becomes part of the narrative. And you're right. So it's not just what happened 25 years ago, or that picture might not just, you know, you might have been 17 when the picture was taken, but the hold it has over you now is shows that it has, over the course of time, continued to hold a much greater claim.
And if I am thinking about something associated with a sad event, I'm quite conscious as well that I do kind of remember the nice things that happened alongside it. So, you know, my grandparents' funerals, I remember actually having a lovely time with cousins and family. And but that's, again, me looking back, and it is another layer of analysis, isn't it? It's another layer of interpretation on it.
Yeah.
And I'm remaking that story for whatever I need that story to do at that time.
No, well, funerals have that effect. And actually, one of my PhD students, her father's a vicar, and he said that he prefers funerals to weddings because, in a way, that at funerals there is this sense in which people are very aware of the importance of the ties that bind. But, of course, at funerals, it's unlike at weddings, it's not appropriate to take photographs, and yet I remember funerals, and I wish in a way I had
a photograph of those.
And it's, you know, it's a bit of a taboo not to do that, but in some respects they are so, you know, in such important occasions.
You often see people who you haven't seen for years who've been really formative in your life, and then for whatever reason you just don't happen to you know, be in touch with them on a daily, weekly, or even yearly basis, and yet there's something very special about sharing that. And that's and, you know, you spend most of your time at funerals telling, you know, stories and sharing memories, don't you?
And do you think you can be nostalgic about negative experiences? In a sense, you've answered that.
Yeah, I think so, because painful experiences, you know, we are the product. It's another sacred story, isn't it? We share our painful experiences too. And we do that for all sorts of reasons, because we're trying to empathise with somebody who's perhaps going through something similar, or because a painful experience or a painful moment can be caught up in, you know, in love and goodness and fun as well, all at the same time. It's quite hard to unpack, isn't it? One particular emotion or one particular memory, but painful experiences. I think just what happens with painful experiences and painful moments is the pain never quite goes away. I don't think, and I think again that's a good thing, because you learn from these things and they're part of you, and they're kind of what's made you. But the pain is never as sharp or as intense, and it doesn't ever last for very long. You know, so if something does terrible happen, relationship breakup, for example, you know, it's so painful at the time, but then it's still, you know, when I think about it now, I'm not kind of particularly wounded by that, but I remember how painful it was, but it has its place. Does that make sense?
No, it does, and sometimes, and part of my journey this week was like I've been staying in a few places that I associate with. In people I used to visit when I was at university, I'm not in touch with, or whatever, you know, painful memories in some cases. But it's taken me decades, but sometimes I knew that I had to stay there en route because and to make peace almost with those periods, rather than have them always as the sort of I can't go through them, can't pass them, because of the associations.
Yeah.
So I think that time can be a great healer, but you couldn't put a, you know, a deadline on it.
No, you can't. And you're not always sure how you are going to feel when you are faced with something that triggers that. And memories can be absolutely, though, anxiety-inducing, can't they? I mean, you know, we're lucky to... Well, we're being much more careful, aren't we, about kind of content warnings or trigger warnings for things, that, you know, sensitive topics. And I think we are more aware of how difficult it can be for some people to revisit certain things. So I don't want to be glib about it. I don't want to kind of say, oh, it's all rosy, you know, everything, time heals everything. Some people have experiences that don't do that. And I think, we have to be mindful of that too.
But what do you think, though, your 5 or your 15-year-old self would think about what you're doing now? Would they think, no way? Or would they be like, that sounds about right?
My 15-year-old self. It's quite an awkward time because I was the new girl at school. I was only at that school doing my GCSEs for about 18 months, and I still have some friends from that period. But it was a confusing time. We'd moved around quite a lot, and you know, you're trying to make friends, but it was quite a complicated time. And I just think, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, and everybody thought that I should kind of know what I wanted to do. I think my 15-year-old self would probably be quite surprised I don't have children, I think, by choice, because I think that would probably be something that I would have expected, you know, you would expect at that age to happen. I think my 15-year-old self might be quite surprised at how long it kind of took me to like settle down and get a proper job. Because I was kind of 30s when I got my job here, and we only bought our first house 5 years ago. That was the first time we'd ever bought a first house. So I think my 15-year-old self might be a bit surprised that I took quite so long to be a grown-up than I have. But I think it probably does make sense that I'm in academia.
But so did you have those ambitions, do you think, from a younger age?
Well, I don't think I really knew what academia was, again, until this moment when I was in Canada, and, you know, my lecturers pulled me aside and said, have you thought about postgraduate work? And I don't think I really knew what postgrad work was then, really. I think, though, you know, I loved school, I loved learning, I liked writing, I liked researching, I liked researching little projects at school and stuff. And I used to, you know, like teaching my poor sister, I used to make her play schools all the time as kids, and I would be the bossy teacher setting her homework and stuff. So we used to kind of like play, you know, schools. I think lots of kids probably did that. So the fact that I'm teaching in some capacity probably wouldn't be a surprise.
And are you still in touch with friends from... Because you've lived in so many different places.
It's hard when you've moved around. Bran has lived in the same place all of his life, 25 years. He's got friends that he grew up with who still... whose parents live in the same town. And I've just never had that. We had a really close friend growing up who was a friend of mine and my sister, and our parents were very good friends. And he was probably my longest friend, but he died about 9 years ago, actually. He was the same age as me, but he died, and he would have been my longest friend, Jason. And I've got a couple of friends from GCSE time. I've got still friends from sixth form, because I did my A-levels round here, so there's still quite a few people who I do... I mean, I pop into Chester and bump into someone I went to school with, you know, which is kind of nice. Most of my kind of friends, closest friends, are probably through university, really. But Facebook is great for that. I have to say, you know, I know it's an evil, I know it's an evil. And yet, at the same time, it means... So I was in Chester having a drink last Wednesday. And it was a bit by chance that I was in, you know, a favourite pub, Brand Place gigs there quite a lot. I'm taking you there tonight. And I was just having a drink with a colleague, with Paul here in work. And we'd gone out for dinner. And in walks this chap. And he just goes, "All right, Dawn." I went, "Yeah, yeah, hi." And then I realised who it was. And it was somebody who I knew in Nuneaton when I was 15 and 16, and we'd been quite good mates, and he was just passing through by chance. Mm. Knew I lived in Chester, but didn't want to do that, you know, "Oh, I'm in Chester for 48 hours, can we meet up for a drink?" Because he was literally just, you know, just passing through. And I know exactly what he's up to because of Facebook. So we do know how each other are, and it just meant it was really lovely to just quite easy to pick up
I had a very strange conversation. I had a very strange experience when I was at, I think, Waterloo Station a few months ago. And I was just waiting to meet someone, and a woman, same age as me, or, well, I know she's exactly the same age as me, who was with her daughter. And she said, "Christopher DC, as I live and breathe." and I thought, "Joe, I haven't seen you, I knew who it was." And she said, "What are you doing here?" And then she paused. She said, "Actually, I know what you're doing here, because I was just reading your post on Facebook." So it's like immediately. So Facebook can be a wonderful bind. But of course, some people reveal their presence on Facebook, some people don't. So you never quite know. So if you like email somebody sometimes, you find that... how are you, how are things, and you never quite know how much the other person knows about you and vice versa.
There's a whole politics about it, isn't it? Like totally raised or changed the way in which we might engage with people who we don't see very much very often. And I think when you do move around a lot, you do end up having kind of like little clusters, so you've got quite an extensive, you know, network, I suppose, in that way. And it is Facebook that, again, helps that, helps, just keeps a bit of stability, you know, to those relationships, really. I'm a bit of a Facebook fan, really. I mean, I use it for work and for family stuff and for friends stuff. But again, you know, how Facebook kind of encourages us to be nostalgic and to reflect and to reminisce. I mean, it's built into the system, isn't it? You know, from there, what were you doing a year ago to... No, the sharing of photos and...
Well, I've only been on Facebook, or properly for 2 years, because I had a presence, but I didn't use it. But now it's almost as though I quite like my online persona and think, ooh, you know, I think I quite like where he's going with this. And of course, when people meet me, I think I'm not quite as, you know, sometimes the posts go a little bit, you know, beyond, and you think, you can get away with it, though. You can get away with something online.
But it's really important for work too. You know, you might meet somebody at a conference and you stay in contact, and it's an easy way of getting back in touch. And it is a way of amplifying your own work, but also the work of people who I think who we do have a responsibility to amplify their work, who might not have the same opportunities and be in the same privileged position as we are. So social media is a force for good, I think, when it's used in that way strategically to amplify the voices that are normally missed out of certain conversations.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. But my very last question, Dawn, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Bit of both. And a bit, not very... I'd like to say I'm a bit more in the present, but I'm not, because I'm, like I said, I'm easily distracted and too much energy and too loud and too noisy and too energetic to be very present very much. I like a bit of both. That's exciting. It's exciting and a bit daunting to look ahead. Can be a bit scary to look ahead too much. I don't tend to plan massively. Like, I tend to know what I'm doing in the next... I've got goals for the next kind of, you know, 3 years or so, things that I've got to do the next 3 or 4 years. After that, I'm not too sure. And I quite like that. I always always kind of think, I say this to students as well, don't worry too much about what you're going to do with your life. That's a horrible thing. Because how boring is that, that it's all mapped out by the time you're 25? You know, why don't you just see what you'd like to do next and then see where that leads you? So I do tend to think about, okay, this is where I am now. What's worked so far to get here? What might I want to do next? And then looking back, I do love a good reminisce, and I do love a good shared story, and I do like that. I think there's something really precious about
that. Dawn, it has been incredible to catch up, and I think, you know, we could have carried on for another 5 hours. But
I do talk.
Yeah, but that was so great to catch up.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.